Dr. Brogan is a holistic women's health psychiatrist. She has a BS in cognitive neuroscience from MIT, an MD from the Weill Cornell Medical College, and clinical training from the NYU School of Medicine. She's board certified in psychiatry, psychosomatic medicine, and integrative medicine, and she currently has a private practice in New York City. I want to read to you a little bit from her book just to give you an idea of what Dr. Brogan is proposing. She writes, over the past 25 years, ever since the FDA approval of Prozac-type medications, we've been taught that drugs can improve the symptoms of and even cure mental illness, particularly depression and anxiety disorders. Today, they are among the most prescribed best-selling drugs, and this has led to one of the most silent and underestimated tragedies in the history of modern healthcare. She continues by saying, symptoms of mental illness are not entirely a psychological problem, nor are they purely a neurochemical issue. Not a single study has proven that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain. She goes on to say that depression is merely a symptom or a sign that something is off balance or ill in the body that needs to be remedied. Depression is a grossly misdiagnosed and mistreated condition today, especially among women, one in seven of whom is being medicated. One in four women in their 40s and 50s use psychiatric drugs. Dr. Brogan writes, although I was trained to think that antidepressants are to the depressed and to the anxious, panicked, OCD, bulimic, and anorexic, what eyeglasses are to the poor sighted, I no longer buy into this bill of goods. She continues on to say that despite what you've been led to believe, antidepressants have repeatedly been shown in long-term scientific studies to worsen the course of mental illness, to say nothing of the risks of liver damage, abnormal bleeding, weight gain, sexual dysfunction, and reduced cognitive function that they entail. The dirtiest little secret of all is the fact that antidepressants are among the most difficult drugs to taper from, more than alcohol or opiates. While you may call it going through withdrawal, we medical professionals have been instructed by Big Pharma to call it discontinuation syndrome, which is characterized by fiercely debilitating physical and psychological reactions. Dr. Brogan, can you start off talking about what led you into the field of psychiatry in the first place?
I always joke that I've accumulated like a very expensive diploma wall in my office. That's pretty much it, because I've spent the last 10 years essentially unlearning everything that I put, you know, all the these sort of blood, sweat, and tears and a ton of money and debt into quote-unquote mastering, right? So I was raised in a very conventional family. My mom is an immigrant, and my dad sort of, you know, rose up from a fairly low socioeconomic tier. And they really instilled in me this idea that, you know, authority is, you know, vested in those who work hard and are intelligent and make a lot of money, right? So I was really trained, as I think so many second-generation kids are, to follow the tracks. And so I either was going to become a doctor or a lawyer. And, you know, I chose to become a doctor mostly because when I was at MIT, I worked on a suicide hotline. I have no idea what compelled me to do this. It was pretty and remains a very serious issue at MIT. There are a number of completed suicides while I was there as an undergrad, and this hotline was called Nightline, and it was an overnight, all-night, sort of helpline for those in distress, and it was supervised. I was supervised weekly by a psychiatrist. And I was majoring and studying neuroscience at the time, mostly because it was the easiest major at MIT. And so the combination of those two efforts really, I think, left me with this illusory impression that we've cracked the code of human behavior. You know, we have it all figured out. Here's the science. Here's what we do to help people. We get them into treatment. And, you know, this is a noble path, right? So I went to medical school to become a psychiatrist, and was very, very interested in the biologics of it. You know, I really sort of gravitated towards psychopharmacology and away from anything psychotherapeutic. That seemed like a total waste of time to me, and I really wanted to get into the serious stuff. And I trained in New York, and the ethos really was that there's something, sort of prestigious about being able to prescribe multiple medications with this sort of, you know, cowboy-like almost bravado to your patients. And I was in my fellowship specializing in medical psychiatry or psychosomatic medicine, which essentially means that, you know, psychiatrists are consulting on medical and surgical patients to help decide what medications to give them, frankly, often for the side effects of their other medical treatments. Mm-hmm. And I was specializing in what's called reproductive psychiatry, which is essentially, again, medicating pregnant and breastfeeding women. I was pregnant myself during my fellowship. And, again, not a holistically minded person, far from it. Mm-hmm. I remember having this moment of writing a prescription for Zoloft for a pregnant patient of mine and thinking, you know, had to sort of voice rise up. And I remember thinking, I would never want to take this medication as a pregnant woman. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so dissonant. You know, I wrote those prescriptions every day, hundreds of them every week, for pregnant and considering conception and postpartum women, and I just ignored it. You know, it was too dissonant to incorporate, so I just ignored it. And it wasn't until about 9 months postpartum when I was diagnosed with my first health problem, and being in the consciousness that I was in, or lack thereof, up until this point, I had no relationship to my body other than that I needed it to cooperate so that I could get done what it is that I needed to get done. You know, I have always been naturally thin, so I ate McDonald's and drank Red Bull and soda and 6 cups of coffee a day and candy every single day. I was notorious for always having candy in my bag. And I never exercised. I felt I didn't, quote unquote, need to. You know, I took birth control for 12 years. I dyed my hair black. You know, I just had no relationship at all to any sort of lifestyle consciousness at all. And I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis or postpartum thyroiditis, largely on a routine physical. And, of course, looking back, I had a ton of symptoms. You know, I was, you know, super forgetful, double-booking patients, falling asleep here and there, you know, forgetting my wallet all over the place, and just felt really flat. But these are all, you know, sort of new mom, you know, type potentially dismissible symptoms. And, you know, lo and behold, I had, you know, numbers really off the charts in terms of autoimmune markers. And I had that same encounter with that voice again because I just had this feeling like, I don't want to take a prescription for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know, that's fine for my patients, but it's, I don't want to do that. And so totally uncharacteristically, I went and sought out the counsel of a naturopath because I knew what conventional medicine had to offer me. And I knew that there was no escape hatch through, you know, the conventional route. And, of course, I put into remission in the space of a year this chronic and, frankly, potentially disabling autoimmune condition. And it raised all sorts of red flags for me. You know, first of all, I'd never learned in my decade of training that you could ever put into remission intentionally an autoimmune condition that otherwise would be chronic. And I never learned that nutrition had any real role, real valid role, let alone an evidence-based role, in the treatment of any illness, period. You know, it was always presented as sort of this window dressing or sort of like a, as your patient's walking out the door, you tell them, you know, it'd be nice if you would stop drinking 6, you know, sodas a day, sort of a thing. And so with the raising of these red flags, I decided I was going to figure out for myself what it is that I didn't learn in my training, and I developed a very intimate relationship with PubMed.gov, which is where all of the index literature is kept, free for everyone to, you know, to read and look at. And since then, I have spent every Saturday about 4 hours every single Saturday of my life trolling through the primary literature with a focus on non-industry funded science. And that has led me to a totally different perspective on medicine.
So Dr. Bergen, let's start about the whole idea of depression and how we got to this place where we see depression as a disease that will be chronically part of our lives forever, where at one point, the National Health Organization expected that you could have a depressive episode maybe once in your life, and a second episode was uncommon. How did we go from that idea about depression to this idea that once you've been diagnosed, you're on a medication for the rest of your life?
Yeah, so we've been told a story about depression, right? And you're alluding to it. We've been told that it's probably a genetic illness. It's really manifests sometimes randomly, but often after a stressor or a trigger. And it's a chemical imbalance that requires lifelong treatment in the form of a pharmaceutical product. And it's really not unlike insulin to a diabetic. So that if you decide or choose or opt out of treatment, it's really a type of noncompliance that can only be blamed, you know, back on the patient for their denial or sort of like incomplete acceptance of this essentially terminal diagnosis, right? Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely what I parroted. It's what I believed, that we had identified discrete disease entities, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depression, and that these diagnostic terms actually reflected sort of bodily disease states. And what I have uncovered, you know, I don't have many original ideas, by the way, but I do think I'm a good curator, and I have consumed the literature and information of so many amazing pioneering thinkers, you know, people like Joanna Moncrief and Irving Kirsch, for example, Peter Breggin, and, you know, what I uncovered researching their research primarily was that the truth of the matter is quite a different story. And in fact, the most important shift, paradigmatic shift, is that none of these psychiatric labels are actually diseases in any way that we understand, you know, the biological evolution of diseases in the human body, right? So they don't, they are not genetically inherited, despite a lot of money going towards substantiating this notion. They're still looking for the genes for these different states, from autism to schizophrenia. It's really an absurd endeavor. It would be like looking for the gene for a fever. Mm-hmm. It really, when you step back for a moment, it's the most colossal, you know, waste of our tax dollars. But the reason that there's such a focus on gene-based disease still in the conventional world is because when a disease is genetic, what does that imply? It implies that there's nothing you can do, right? That your lifestyle is irrelevant, that the environment and all of, you know, Monsanto's glyphosate saturating every inch of this planet is irrelevant, and all you can really do is take your medication, right? So it's almost understandable why, with collusion between, you know, government, industry, and the medical profession, we have this focus, hyper-focus on gene-based illness models. But it's not a disease in that way. We don't have any discrete mechanism. You know, I reviewed 6 decades of literature looking for proof that depression has anything to do, frankly, with serotonin imbalance, and I could not find it. From animal studies all the way up to, you know, analysis of postpartum suicide, post-suicide victims, you know, brains, you know, looking at metabolites in the blood and the urine, and the science just isn't there. And it's time that we accept, and frankly, the researchers have accepted this. You know, research itself, primary research, has moved on from what is called the monoamine hypothesis of depression, or the chemical imbalance theory, because the science just isn't there and the medications don't work in the ways that we wish that they did. So the primary research has moved on to look at things like the inflammatory model, like the connectedness between the immune system, the gut, and the brain, for example, looking at, you know, different ways that hormones can masquerade as psychiatric pathology. And that's all in the primary literature. You know, my book and my website have hundreds and hundreds of references. None of this is really just theory that I've cooked up. So it's a bit of a shift we have to make to accept that we've been using these impressionistic terms. But once you make that shift, you begin to understand that, you know, depression is not one thing. it's many, 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 many different things to many, many, many different people.
We keep trying to make it a one-size-fits-all disease when really depression is a normal response to a lot of triggers in the body, whether it's a trauma or a grief or a loss, right, a psychosocial reason, or if there's something that has impacted our gut or our health that depresses the mood because the body's focused on trying to heal. Would I be on the right course with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what I've come to understand. You know, again, I came from this idea that suffering and pain are bad, we have to get rid of them, and you'd be stupid not to, right? So, you know, as somebody who's now gone on to have home births, I used to believe that it was irresponsible to the point of, you know, questionable judgment that a woman would ever do anything but schedule an elective cesarean section. And so I have made a very radical leap in my thinking. So I can see both sides, you know, of this discussion. But what you're suggesting is exactly what I've come to believe, which is that, you know, depression, or frankly any symptoms, but we'll just talk about this, that depression is really an invitation to take a look under the hood, right? Because in my experience of reversing what otherwise would potentially be chronic mental illness, reversing it sometimes in the space of 1 to 2 months in my practice, in my experience, there are many discrete causes that once you identify it, you're on the road to, you know, your get out of jail free card. You know, you're on the road to not only resolving your symptoms and, you know, opting out of a lifelong relationship to a diagnosis. But of course, what I've, you know, really come to focus on now in my writing is that you really give yourself sort of entry to your next chapter. Because anyone who has survived a chronic and potentially degenerative disease will tell you that their entire life is different. They love differently, they think differently, they eat differently, they move differently. Everything is different, and it's almost like they've gotten a second chance at living in, through a totally different lens. So that's really what I'm after. It's not just about meds or no meds or symptoms or no symptoms. It's about how can we take this invitation to really transform and become so much more empowered, so much more who we're meant to be, you know, what we're here for. So a lot of the reversible causes of depression that I focus on are on the bodily level, because it's my perspective that entering through bodily healing really gives you this opportunity to explore so many other arenas of your life.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Dr. Kelly Brogan, holistic psychiatrist and author of A Mind of Your Own. I'd like to continue with my conversation with Dr. Brogan here on Public Radio KCBX. I guess the conversation is, how do we empower people to trust their own inner sense of how to live?
Yeah. I mean, I could speak all day about this, but I'll just say briefly that one of the most important things I've learned is that you can't convince anyone of anything. Mm-hmm. And really, I don't see myself, and I'm sure you would agree, as being in a position to really persuade anyone to do anything that they otherwise wouldn't feel inclined to do.
Right.
But we are in a very important time in history where there is such a saturation of information that it really is, the onus really is upon the individual to understand what their inner compass is telling them, mm-hmm. and to dig deep and sort of explore what it is that you feel aligns with your truth, mm-hmm. and to pursue that, right? So it's sort of the end of the guru era, right? Because there are way too many gurus for us to ever be able to live a sane, healthy, and happy life, you know, waiting to be told what to do, whether that's from the conventional side or the holistic side. So my intention with my patients and with, you know, this book, and my intention is to activate that inner voice and then let everyone go. You know, if you're in my practice for longer than a year, that's, you know, I'm concerned about that. My goal is to activate that voice and let people go so that they can exercise that self-authority. But listen, it's not for everyone. And there, you know, if the story that resonates with you is that the body is fundamentally flawed, it's a minefield of errors, and you really need modern medicine in all of its, you know, sort of technology and refined science, you need it to navigate this very dangerous place called life, you know, then probably the pharmaceutical model is going to be a fit for you. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't make any sense for you to even read this book. but the truth is that you need all of the available information before you can even make that decision for yourself. And so that's where I've really come down on the side of informed consent. And it's really where my only remaining beef is, because as a physician who prescribed countless medications, I don't feel that I was in a position to truly inform my patients about what the science has told us with regard to efficacy, risk, and alternatives in any of the treatments that I, you know, doled out over the years. So that's what it really comes down to. Once you have exposure to all the information, then you have to feel into what's right for you and follow that voice.
Well, two things. One, I think it's challenging for people to follow their voice if they even start to feel like what I'm doing isn't quite right, because there's almost a bullying or such a pressure from the medical field to follow their protocol, you know, especially for parents that are trying to decide what to do with their children. You know, we almost have we have a whole field of child abuse allegations if parents don't mm-hmm. follow the protocol their doctors are telling them to follow. So I think that's a challenge, right? To even if you know at your gut level that what you're doing isn't helping you, to go against the medical model is dangerous in some ways for people. So can you speak to that? And then let's talk about trusting our gut and what that really means.
Yeah, so I just wrote and published on my blog a post about the stages of transformation, because I've really watched not only my own journey, but I've watched my patients, particularly those coming off of psychiatric medication, really move through these stages almost in a predictable way. And so I began to pay attention and try to quantify it so I could provide a bit of a roadmap, you know, for people who are just entering the process and really in that dark night of the soul, you know, feeling hopeless, feeling like maybe it would be easier to crawl back up into the uterus, you know, rather than proceed through the birth canal. And, you know, one of the most important elements of this transformational process is integration, right? So you don't have to argue with anyone if you don't interact with the system. You know, we are at a time now where more and more options are becoming available to really opt out, you know, get off the grid and opt out. You know, you should never be arguing with your doctor. Get a different doctor. Work with a non-doctor. Work with an acupuncturist or a chiropractor or, you know, a clinician who has some exposure to true healing rather than just symptom suppression. Mm-hmm. So when you're in that phase of having awakened to other options but feeling somewhat ambivalent about it, then you end up being in your conventional psychiatrist's office arguing about the fact that it's your right as a patient to consider a taper of your medication. But you don't have to see that psychiatrist, right? So these are the ways that we integrate over time, and we begin to align our beliefs, our actions, and our decisions so that they all are reflecting the same reality. But my observation is that you can't commit, really commit, until you have had an experience that really decimates all of your assumptions and beliefs. And the most available experience is 30 days of strict dietary change.
So, and I want to talk about the gut, because, you know, we use that metaphor in everything. Trust your gut, trust your instincts.
Right.
And you talk about the biology of depression, or, you know, the genesis of depression being in that inflammatory state that kind of starts with our gut. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you're moving away from, or you're moving into a different idea of where depression comes from?
Yes. So, you know, one of the areas I began to focus on once I let go of the serotonin theory was what's called the cytokine theory of depression. And what this basically suggests, and this is almost 20 years old now in the primary literature, what this suggests is that depression is a collection, it's a syndrome, it's a collection of symptoms that evolved as a part of something called sickness behavior. And sickness behavior evolutionarily was really intended to help us restore, you know, rejuvenate and regenerate behaviorally, right? So what do? What are the symptoms of depression? Social avoidance, often decreased appetite, decreased interest in sex, changes in sleep, you know, sometimes hypervigilance and what we would call anxiety, or a focus on something that might help us resolve our issues. You know, this collection of behaviors has been thought to be adaptive over the course of our evolution, but now with this chronic, largely non-infectious, they call it sterile inflammation, so this chronic exposure to stimuli and stressors in our environment that are asking our body to adapt continuously, we have, you know, really gotten ourselves more chronically ill than we would have ever been in the history of our, you know, development. And so this perspective really brings depression under the same umbrella as so many other chronic diseases, whether it's heart disease or diabetes or cancer and autoimmunity, in understanding that inflammation is really the message, it's the language that the body uses to communicate its efforts to adapt. It's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's just information. And so the suggestion, you know, that depression may at times be an inflammatory process really leads us to ask yet another question, which is, where is the inflammation coming from? Mm-hmm. And we now know, again, from basic science that this inflammatory signal can start from a thought, right, a belief or a feeling. Mm-hmm. It can start from an exposure, a chemical exposure, or, you know, I would say, and often, it starts at the gut level. Because our gut, right, so this alimentary canal that begins at the mouth and ends at the anus, is really our most important interface with the natural world. From when we are born, we begin sampling the world. That's what our tonsils are even for, right? Of course, they're not vestigial. You know, we begin sampling the world with our mouth. And we learn about it. We educate our immune system because, you know, the modern estimate is that 70 to 80% of our immune system is housed in our gut wall. And so it's only when the gut is compromised, right? How does it get compromised? It's compromised largely through an abusive diet, right? So when it's compromised, you know, there is loss of integrity in the tightness of our junctions in the lining of the gut. There are changes in the community, the ecosystem in the gut, which is now referred to, as you said, as the microbiome, which we are now understanding reflects our deep and inextricable relationship to the organismic world, you know, everything from viruses to fungus to bacteria and archaea, even worms, you know, that helminths, you know, that we have co-evolved with these organisms to the extent that we are not human in the way that we think we are, that we are instead this super organism, right? The term in the literature is a holobiont. And that the boundaries that we think we have, you know, our skin separates us from the rest of the world, are really in many ways just illusory. So what that suggests is we need to get back to a deeper connection with nature. It's really poetic in so many ways, right? And so how do we forge that connection? It's really pretty simple. And there have been even studies looking at 10 days in nature, how you can change all of these different parameters on, you know, in terms of blood count estimates of inflammatory markers. But we change it by essentially restoring so many of the behaviors that have served us for many millions of years. Things like natural sun exposure, honoring sleep, things like movement, and of course eating foods that are as close as humanly possible to actual foods, right? Unprocessed, without chemicals. And again, you know, my orientation around, you know, dietary inclusion is one that allows for animal foods, including red meat. But I would say you could still make a lot of progress if you just clean up the packages and take out the chemicals, right? Because we're not meant to evolve. You know, I used to think, well, given another, I don't know what, couple hundred years, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years, maybe we will adapt to this environment that is so corrupted at this point. But I've actually come to think differently. I think that it would actually be a violation of the very almost like contract we have with the universe, if you want to look at it that way, to ever adapt to a state of such dissonance with this, you know, with the natural world and with our, you know, connection to this web. We're meant to be, you know, in concert, working in unison with, you you know, all of the cyclical elements of this planet and all of the different, you know, organisms and animals. And we're not meant to be automatons, you know, that sort of isolate ourselves off and expect to thrive and flourish. So it's a message, again, and it's a calling back to, you know, what Jane Liedloff has called the continuum, right? It's a calling back to our native wisdom, and that's really where I've come to appreciate, you know, sort of looking at how Indigenous people have access to something I think we all long for, right? This sort of vital, joyful, rich experience that certainly doesn't seem available to us when we're like punching the clock Monday through Friday and stressing about getting our kids to soccer. You know, something feels missing, right. And I think this is a big part of it.
You don't sound like a psychiatrist, Dr. Brogan. You don't sound like a psychiatrist.
Unbrainwashing.
This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And let's pull it into my world of talk therapy for a second. People do experience psychosocial traumas in their life that can trigger depression and can trigger anxiety and OCD. You know, we see that connection that we have a traumatic event or something that happened in childhood and it lingers throughout adulthood. And we have symptoms of that trauma throughout our life. So would you say that in some ways those griefs and traumas attack our gut and our gut reacts with in that inflammatory response that, I mean, am I on the right track of connecting those two things?
You know, at the basic science level, the answer is yes. You know, that trauma, stress, grief, really stress is the one that is most studied at the basic science level, absolutely impact our immune system and seemingly disturb our gut microbiota. But what's really sort of like insipid and anemic about that perspective is that there's no room in basic science, even things like psychoneuroimmunology and all these fields and disciplines that I feel really excited about, there's no room in that discourse for meaning. It's still a biological perspective.
Right.
And even if we're including the mind in the form of stress, there's no room for what is the meaning of this for you, right? So, like, I developed Hashimoto's. It's arguable that there was a lot of embedded meaning in that for me, in my symptoms of, you know, sort of shutting down, you know, cloudiness, flatness, fatigue. I needed to take the invitation of this diagnosis to become so much more fully expressed as a woman, and I feel that that's exactly the gift that was given to me by that diagnosis. And had I just, you know, complied with my Synthroid prescription for the rest of life, well, wow, why would I have missed out on quite an important transformation for me in this lifetime? So there is something, I think, very important, and I will be publishing an article soon on symbolic diseases. Again, this is I pulled from PubMed. This is a primary research paper about the fact that many of our illnesses have a symbolism to us that we have to investigate and acknowledge. And that's really something that psychotherapy is designed and developed to do, is to understand the narrative meaning of a given, you know, experience and often a physiologic experience, include that in the conversation so that it's not this Cartesian, you know, dualistic perspective of, well, here's what's going on in your thoughts and your mind and your love life and your family, and this is what's going on in your body. You know, take your meds, get to your doctor, and we'll talk about the rest of your life. No, they're all synthesized. They're all related. And, you know, on the subject of trauma and grief, you know, one of the most impactful books I've read is by a psychotherapist and arguably a grief expert named Francis Weller. And he wrote a book called The Wild Edge of Sorrow, which I found to be, you know, profound. And, you know, I've written about it again recently, just trying to distill it for people, you know, what his message is, which is that, you know, we all harbor many, many layers of grief, you know, from the pain of joy, meaning like once you connect and allow yourself to experience love and contentment and joy, what's the underbelly of that is loss, right? Even when we get sick, there's a grief there because we have to experience the potential loss of our health, the potential for our own death. And of course, then the very concrete losses we experience in those of, you know, around us who pass on. But there are so many other layers of grief. You know, there's planetary grief. You know, when you see pictures of, you know, birds slicked in oil, something hurts about that, right? It hurts for all of us. And this is going on as a white noise all around us all the time. You know, there are legions of different sources of this kind of pain and trauma that we're only ever taught to get over, right? And according to the DSM, our favorite book, right? Mm-hmm. In the fifth iteration, you know, the bereavement clause was removed. So mm-hmm. now if you feel deep grief to the point of alteration of your behavior for more than 2 weeks, you're eligible for prescription medication for that pathological manifestation.
I talk about
something
that all the time.
Something is very wrong,
and,
right?
So and postpartum.
It's such an important topic. I'm so glad, you know, you're addressing it as well.
Well, that's why, so I wanted to make that connection with the food and the gut and the inflammation, that it's not, when our gut does get inflamed, it's not necessarily, as you said, a bad thing. It's a message. It's like, oh, something's going on. How do I best care for myself? And I think that's what I hear underlined in your story, is that we have to tune in and listen to our gut and then realize, how do I best care for myself? I can't prevent trauma. I can't prevent all sadness. I can't prevent all disease. But when my body or I experience these feelings, how do I best care for myself? Is that
the underlying story? I would say it's that, but that the reason that it matters how you care for yourself in advance of these experiences, what real preventive medicine is, mm-hmm. is so that we can cultivate resiliency, right? So I'm in my office on Madison Avenue in New York. I'm not creating euphoria in every patient, but I am offering them through this process an experience of resiliency. What is resiliency? It's a deep trust that you've got what it takes to move through an experience. Period. So when you get hit with a source of grief, you know, if you've been, eating special K bars for breakfast and drinking 6 cups of coffee, you know, having 3 glasses of wine before bed and, you know, pizza for dinner, odds are you're going to have all these layers of static, physical, psychiatric static, getting in the way of your ability to really be present to the sources of emotional relevance in your life. And that's all you have to do, really, is be present to it. But it is so much harder, if not impossible, to do that when you have all of this, these other layers, you know, obfuscating that access. And so that's really what I, you know, seek to provide for people. You know, it wasn't until, personally, I moved through my own physical healing that I began to even hear that inner voice, that I began to even ask these big questions, and I began to feel safe enough to sit with something that otherwise would have felt totally intolerable. You know, for example, the death of my mentor last year. And, you know, this is really the goal. When you clean things up for yourself, when you heal your body, you really give yourself room to relate so differently to your sentient life. And I think that's something worth investing in, obviously.
And so you must be really popular within your profession. I'm wondering how the pushback has been for you, because, you know, the American Psychiatric Association, although in the last 5 years at their own convention, they have said, oh, I think we've been prescribing too many medications. I mean, that came up, I think, 5 years ago for the first time. But that's like turning a ship, right? Trying to get the American Psychiatric Association to change protocol. So where are you in standing with your profession?
So it's an interesting thing. You know, when I published this book in March, I really expected a lot of pushback and a lot of static. And for whatever reason, it's been a really beautiful experience, so contrary to what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because it's very clear that I'm not interested in debating. And, you know, I have read an order of magnitude more literature than pick any one of my colleagues. I hate to sort of, you know, put it in a comparative, competitive way. But the truth is, when you're going against the grain, you have to arm yourself with science in ways that when you are practicing the status quo, you know, gold standard, nobody reads papers. Why would they? They're doing exactly what they're told to do. So maybe it is that a lot of my colleagues know that I know the science pretty well. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why no one bothers me. But I think it may be something more energetic, that, you know, there is an opportunity that we have here to create something totally outside, totally different, like a sparkly new tent, you know, on a different plot of land, rather than entering the existing tent and trying to, you know, rip things up in there. I'm not interested in doing that. I have zero expectation, faith, or confidence that the mainstream is ever going to get with the program in any meaningful way or on any time frame that would be relevant to us. But I have tremendous confidence that the entire structure is going to implode in my lifetime. And it's going to do so passively because something so much more compelling, so much more powerful, and frankly, so much more beautiful is being created right now on a grassroots level with simple guidance, you know, from people like me and many of my colleagues who've come to this sort of awareness as bridges from the conventional world to, you know, really a more ancient story that's been upheld by so many practitioners, you know, again, who can access this traditional wisdom. So that's more my perspective, and you know, you'll never see me engaging in a debate. I'm happy to. It's totally my personality and temperament, but it's just so low yield, and I really believe everyone needs to do exactly what feels right for them, and I just have a lot of confidence that more and more people are going to start to resonate with this story.
Well, and it seems like maybe you're coming out with the book and, you know, all the science, because when people pick up your book, the last probably 30 pages are all your notations of the science that backs up what you said in the book, which is fabulous. That maybe it's resonating on a deep level with a lot of clinicians in our profession who have felt that they were going down the wrong path and just didn't have the energy or the confidence like you'd had to question it. And so in our last few minutes, Dr. Brogan, can we talk about the nutritional path? What is the foundation of this nutritional path that you feel like will set people up to kind of come out of their depressed states or have more ownership of their emotions?
Yeah. So I am passionate about nutrition as the portal to healing, and I certainly don't believe that there is one diet for everyone. I've been a longtime follower of Weston Price, who, if you know, if anyone knows who he is, very much, you know, naturalistically through his research around the globe, evidenced the fact that there is not one diet that makes people healthy. I also had the deep privilege of working with Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who, in my opinion, is one of the most important figures in modern medicine, who worked with 10 different diets in his practice for 27 years to put metastatic cancers and degenerative diseases of all varieties into complete long-term remission, you know, without the aid of any conventional treatment or pharmaceuticals. So I come to my work with patients with a template that is a starting point. And the template is very simple. It's critical, you know, that the sourcing of these foods, you know, be conscious. So the animal foods are all from pastured animals who've lived their lives on grass. The produce is as close to 100% organic, or at least the, you know, Dirty Dozen, so to speak, environmental working groups identified Dirty Dozen are organic. So it's essentially, you know, animal foods including red meat, poultry and fish, eggs. It's all manner of vegetables, including starchy vegetables like beets, carrots, sweet potato, for example, nuts and seeds, a lot of oils. Whether it's ghee, which is a clarified butter, coconut oil, olive oil, and then fruit, really of all varieties that are appealing. And I focus a lot on filtered water, so adequate hydration, actually adequate salt, so natural sea salt or a Himalayan salt. And it's really simple. So this diet should taste really good. It should be filling in ways that the conventional eating patterns we engage in aren't. You know, I went from being starving all the time and literally not being able to go an hour and a half without eating to, you know, I haven't eaten yet today and it's, you know, 1 o'clock. So it's a very metabolically shifting diet. All of my patients lose weight, frankly, whether they wanted to or not. And it's really pretty simple, right? Like, I don't have time to do complicated things in the kitchen, so the recipes that I use are all very simple, some Italian influence, thanks to my mom. And the idea is that you pay attention. So I encourage people to eat red meat, for example, up to four times a week. Yeah. And this obviously feels very radical to a lot of folks, especially with a lot of the propaganda misinformation around saturated fat and red meat, which, of course, is all in every single study that's ever been conducted. It's all industrialized meat, which I would never allow a patient of mine to touch with a 10-foot pole, of course. But the idea is that then you begin to pay attention to what it is that you want. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like eating, you know, filet mignon and hamburgers three times a day? Then you need to do that. Do you feel like eating salad six times a week? Then you need to do that. So you just sort of note that over the first month within the parameters of the diet that I recommend. And that's how we begin to understand how to tailor this to you. Because in my opinion, there's no tests on the market that can do that for you. And that there's some, you know, deep meaning in that. You have to do it. You have to wake up and do it. But I really think that when we take addictive foods out, like coffee, like alcohol, like sugar, like wheat, like dairy, then we really allow for a clearer signal between food and body.
Well, and in some ways, it seems like when we get the processed foods out or the foods that are inflaming our gut, once the gut is calm, then maybe we're able to deal with the social emotional issues that are also stirring around. It's almost like we have to clear the way to get to the source of our pain.
I think that's very true.
And Dr. Brogan, just to finish up, I would really love for you to share with people kind of a couple things they could do today to start to feel better. You know, two things they could do just today before they go out and find your book that might help them on their path towards healing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the number one thing to do would be to change your breakfast. If you just go online and you Google KB, which are just my initials, smoothie, you'll find a video that I've recorded or a couple posts I've put on my site for this simple smoothie recipe that is, you know, no special powders, nothing you have to buy necessarily. It's all kitchen ingredients, but it does involve a lot of natural fat. So pastured raw egg yolks, ghee, nut butter, coconut oil, and it tastes like chocolate milk. It's totally delicious. I give it to my kids all the time. And if you try that for breakfast, for example, instead of, you know, a bagel or toast or cereal no breakfast, you could literally feel different within 1 to 2 days. And the reason is because you're setting the tone for your blood sugar stability throughout the day, and blood sugar ups and downs can masquerade as all manner of psychiatric symptoms, from anxiety to fatigue, and it's such a critical piece of the puzzle. So if you just change your breakfast, and again, it's not hard and it tastes good, so if you just start there, then you might begin to see that there's a lot more, you know, potential here than you ever thought.
And so what I'm hearing is that the things that we thought we needed to avoid, like fats, good healthy fats, and meat, are actually critical in the stabilizing of our blood sugar, which helps to stabilize our moods. And there it all becomes one big circle.
Again, and this is not an issue for everyone. Mm-hmm. Not everyone should be on a high natural fat diet.
Okay.
But certainly if you are struggling with symptoms that have been labeled ADHD, chronic fatigue, and depression, this could be a massive game changer.
My guest today has been Dr. Kelly Brogan, holistic women's health psychiatrist, anti-medication advocate, and author of A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression and How Women Can Heal Their Bodies and Reclaim Their Lives. And we actually challenged a lot of deeply held beliefs about medication, mental health, nutrition, and well-being here today. And I'm actually still processing all of this information and not sure where I stand on all of her points or all of her protocols. But I am fascinated by the perspective and the science behind Dr. Brogan's work. And I imagine that a lot of you have come up with some personal reactions and questions and comments in response to today's program. But until next week, you can be a part of our conversation by visiting our Facebook page. You can leave comments there. You can follow us on Instagram at The Reluctant Therapist. And you can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can listen to this and other shows, previous shows at kcbx.org, or by podcasting through iTunes. And as always, I appreciate your support and participation in this program, and I thank you for being a part of our community, and thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.